Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts every week from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in.
We are back with another episode of Lending Forward, and we have an episode full of hot topics today. With the administration change, we know it'll always bring shifts in economic policy, in regulatory oversight, and it always causes a little bit of chaos. So I am joined today with two wonderful guys, and they're so smart that they're going to help us understand what's going on with all of our different topics. So I've got with me today Pete Mills, the Senior Vice President, Residential Policy and Member Engagement at the MBA, and Justin Wiseman, who is the Vice President for Residential Policy and Managing Regulatory Counsel for the MBA. All of us at Atlantic Bay are so appreciative of the MBA, and I am even more appreciative of you guys taking out some time of your busy day to chit chat with us. So, hey guys.
How are you?
I'm good. Good. How are you, Justin?
Doing well. Appreciate Atlantic Bay and everything you guys do for MBA. So really happy to be here.
Yeah.
It's mutual. So we've got a ton of topics that we can dive into. So I want to kind of kick us off with the new administration. I mean, they have really come in with a bang. What shifts do y'all think we're going to see in the mortgage industry due to the administration shifts or changes?
Sure. I'll take a start at this and I'll have Justin jump in. But we are in uncharted territory in terms of both the scale of the potential change that's occurring and the pace that it's happening at. So we're talking internally amongst my staff. We're sort of in this COVID footing of waiting to see what happens and then being in this rapid response mode, because this is new territory. There's a lot of uncertainty. The whole DOGE effort is a new phenomenon. There aren't established rules of the road for how this works. So we are in sort of fast reaction mode. And I think when we get into that process, our members, your people, your employees, your LOs, your branch managers are really important to the process. You will be the first ones to experience some sort of breakdown in process that you'll let us know about and we'll react to it. I don't think anybody thinks that all the agencies are perfect the way they are. There's certainly room for change and room for staffing changes and reductions and the like. We've been focused on trying to communicate that there are certain functions, whether it's at HUD or at CFPB, that have to be viable from an operational standpoint. So think about the APOR situation a week ago. Were they going to publish? Were they not going to publish? And then in the HUD context, there's so many things going on at HUD right now in terms of program modernization, technology upgrades, all of which are designed to make the programs more efficient, protect taxpayers, all good things, but you need staff to run those. So we're trying to make those kind of communications right now so that as this process unfolds, the things that are mission critical to our industry and to independent mortgage bankers in particular are protected.
I totally agree with Pete. And I think there's sort of three things to look at, two of which are very, perhaps headwinds for the mortgage industry, and one of which is very positive. So let's start with what's very positive, right? This was the most housing focused campaign that I can remember. Both President Trump and Vice President Harris ran on campaigns explicitly aimed at providing for more affordable housing. And obviously that's great for the mortgage industry. And President Trump followed through with that with an executive order asking all agencies to find ways to deliver price relief for Americans who want to buy homes. So that's, I think, a really positive sign to keep an eye on. The two things to watch for that might be headwinds are first what Pete identified, right? As a mortgage industry, we rely on a lot of the plumbing for our industry that's at federal agencies. And if those agencies are diminished, it's very likely that making loans may be more difficult. The last piece is, of course, the macro environment, right? If we see tariffs that result in high lumber costs or, you know, components for home building getting much more expensive, this will obviously create a drag on affordable home ownership for new homeowners by raising the cost of housing construction. So I sort of look at it as one very positive tailwind, a desire for more affordable housing, and potential headwinds around cutting things that are vital to our industry or a macro environment that's not conducive to first-time home buyers.
We're going to get into all of this, because I want to dig into literally everything you just said. I do want to take a step back, because it just kind of dawned on me as you guys were talking. All of us at Atlantic Bay are very familiar with the MBA and what you all do for, you know, us as independent mortgage bankers. Do you guys mind taking a few minutes and just talking through the MBA, how you guys support the industry, and what exactly you two specifically do for the MBA?
Sure, I'll happy to take a run at that. So obviously, policy and advocacy are probably the cornerstone of the work that we do on behalf of the industry, both in Washington, D.C., at the state level. We do a lot of work supporting our state associations, making sure that they have the resources and the tools to advocate successfully in the states as well. That's particularly important for the independent mortgage bankers for obvious reasons. The education component, you're all familiar with our conferences, education, including things like School of Mortgage Banking and those sorts of things. So it's a big platform. It's a big tent. My team focuses on policy and advocacy. And we sort of divide that into sort of two functions. Justin manages the core policy work of analyzing the rules, analyzing the legislation that gets introduced, developing an advocacy strategy around those. But how do we make policy? We have a whole committee infrastructure that Justin's team manages, but we also have what we call our strategic industry engagement function. So we're the big tent. We represent all of the real estate finance industry, but we have groups that we try to work with our members in their business model, in their product, in their channel, so that everybody kind of feels like they have a home, their corner underneath the tent. So we have an independent mortgage banker executive council. We have an IMB network that we has a monthly call. And we spend a lot of time listening to our members in their business model, in their, some of our groups are based around a product. We have a reverse mortgage group, for example. So we try to get all that information from each segment of the industry, each channel, each product set, in order to make policy that sort of rises the tide for all boats. We don't want to make choices that say, well, we're going to do this for the banks and we'll pick up the IMBs next time. We try to really focus holistically and make policy in a way that lifts all boats.
That's awesome. And we so much appreciate you. And shameless plug, the education that MBA puts out, everyone should take advantage. There's free education. School Mortgage Banking was phenomenal. So you guys just do a wonderful job. But going back into, you know, all of the different changes, I know for all of our listeners, they would be super upset if I didn't ask this, but what, with the new administration, what are they going to do, or are they going to do anything to help with interest rates?
Well, Justin touched on that a little bit. I think long-term mortgage rates are really a macro economic policy issue. Mm-hmm. The Fed controls short-term rates. They don't control the 10-year treasury. That's the market expectations around inflation. So I don't think there's a lot. I'll take that back. Fiscal policy is another big driver. So look, the Fed is on pause right now in terms of any further rate cuts. Their focus is on short-term rates. We all look at the 10-year treasury and mortgage rates. That's not really directly in the Fed's hands. So inflation is proving stubborn. Justin mentioned the uncertainty around what's going to happen with tariffs. Is this a negotiating position? Are they going to go into effect? If they go into effect, for how long? That can really be a driver for inflation. And then the other big one here, deficits in the debt. Now, the administration does have a role there. I think certainly the work that they're trying to do on DOGE is intended to drive down spending. But at the same time, we are about to kick off a tax debate in Congress about extending the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. Just extending existing law is a $4.5 trillion hit to the deficit over the 10-year period that they're looking at. So a lot of macro policy headwinds that are going to make lower interest rates a bit of a challenge. So our forecast for right now for the next year, sort of a trading range, I would call it, of, you know, low to mid sixes to low to mid sevens, and a lot of uncertainty that hopefully will begin to clear up over the course of the course of the next year. If tariffs are a short-term issue, a negotiating ploy, if we can get some deficit reduction as part of the tax package, those things could help drive rates down in the longer run. But there is so much uncertainty right now. So that's sort of the rate story, and forecasting rates is a fool's errand. So I'm not gonna go beyond sort of Mike's 1 year forecast.
I wouldn't put you on the spot to go further. Thank you for putting a 1 year forecast out there for our listener base. And, you know, you and I were talking about this before we hit record, but uncertainty is never anybody's friend. So, I mean, how do you guys see the future of independent mortgage bankers kind of evolving over the next 5 to 10 years?
So that's a great question. The IMBs, and this has been my focus since joining MBA in 2012, of really trying to focus on the needs of the independent mortgage banker and address a lot of the concerns coming out of the financial crisis, for which I think IMBs really stepped up post-Great Financial Crisis in terms of market share of originations, now more recently in the servicing space. Banks have pulled back for a whole variety of reasons. Some are regulatory policy related. Others are sort of reputational related. We need banks in the market. Banks provide our warehouse funding. They provide our MSR financing. We need them in the market as servicers as well. But right now, IMBs are close to two-thirds of the origination market, a little bit over half of the servicing market. So as monoline institutions, they don't have other business lines to go into. So our focus on IMBs for the foreseeable future, they are the ones that are doing the work in the marketplace. And we spend a lot of time trying to understand the needs, the concerns, the policy issues that they face, whether it's long-term, the future of the GSEs is critical to the independent mortgage banker. Mm-hmm. They are building capital. Conservatorship was never intended to be a permanent state. At some point, they'll come out. So when they come out, what do they look like? Spend a ton of time thinking about that. So, the need for a federal backstop on the GSEs is critical to keep rates low, keep a 30-year fixed rate TBA market active, deep liquid market. But other sort of regulatory issues in that space, I think one of the biggest issues for independent mortgage bankers has been the level playing field that was created post-Great Financial Crisis. No longer do the largest lenders have single-digit G fees that are, dramatically lower than everybody else's. We have a level playing field. That's really important to competition, really important to the independent mortgage banker going forward. So they are our mortgage market today. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about how to protect that. Mm-hmm. And Justin, do you spend a lot of time?
I think the other piece, I agree, and I will probably get into this more because it is so central and important to IMBs and honestly the whole mortgage market, and that's GSE release. Mm-hmm. But the other piece that I think the administration, it was an issue and also a place where the administration could help, is relieving a little bit of the liquidity strain that IMBs face in times of increased delinquency, right? Everyone knows that Ginnie servicing, there's a fundamental timing mismatch, right? You pay the money out and you wait a really long time to get paid back. All that money's dollar good. right? You know, you are going to be paid back. So it's not like the government is losing any more or less money by reimbursing servicers faster, but that would help servicers manage their liquidity. Mm-hmm. So it's a small thing, but something like FHA reimbursing servicers for taxes and insurance payments more timely would be a support to IMBs and very welcome should we see, unfortunately, an economic kind of downturn.
Yeah, that's a great point. The Ginnie Mae issues as well, in terms of, you know, how do you access liquidity from your servicing portfolio? Mm-hmm. A lot of issues on Ginnie Mae's plate right now. And, you know, making sure that they have the staff there to prioritize and execute, really important. We put a number of proposals in front of them to address the liquidity issue, really important issue going forward. And then obviously FHA, IMBs are the primary, you know, they're 90% of the market for FHA and VA, and making sure those programs are viable going forward. So looking at the MIP, if you want to make housing affordable, a MIP cut would do it almost instantaneously. That said, FHA delinquencies are rising. So if you're going to cut the MIP, you're going to also have to take a look at what's driving FHA delinquencies at the same time.
Was there all really good point. Let's back up because you talked a lot about the GSEs. And I think, you know, there's a lot of noise out there about, you know, Fannie and Freddie coming out of conservatorship. It's a complicated process. And I think a lot of people listening and, you know, I know there's also a lot of people at Atlantic Bay that have a lot of questions. Can you all, in the simplest way possible, explain, one, what actually might happen if they're released, but then also, can you give kind of a backstory on how they were put into conservatorship and why they should or would come out eventually?
That's a challenge, but let's try it.
Challenge accepted.
Who gets the swing of that pitch first? Maybe I'll do the gross oversimplification.
So, how they got there, obviously, you know, going into the Great Financial Crisis, they had huge portfolios of mortgages. They had also purchased large positions in subprime Alt-A securities. A lot of stated income lending was being done through the GSEs. They were essentially insolvent. And when they were insolvent, FHFA, well, at the time it was OFAO, they got renamed as part of the process, had a choice. They could put them into receivership and wind them down, or they could put them in conservatorship and try to buy time so that they could eventually come out. So that's why I say conservatorship was never intended to be a permanent state. Mm-hmm. But it does raise a lot of challenges. You know, there was a point in time, if you go back to the early 20-teens, and there were efforts to do what I call sort of big bang GSE reform legislation. And at that point in time, it wasn't even clear necessarily that the GSEs would survive and do we need to reimagine the entire market. Today, I think after this long-term timeout, if you will, in conservatorship, they're building capital. The mortgage market is dramatically reformed in terms of the types of products we produce, the risks that they take in purchasing and securitizing. To use a football analogy, whereas 10, 12 years ago, we might have been in the shadow of our own goalpost, today, all the reforms that have been put into place by FHFA, the fact that they're building capital, the fact that the mortgage market is reformed, whether we're across the 50-yard line or in the red zone, we are way further down the field than we were. And the opportunity to bring them out is there. Mm-hmm. But how you do it is really important. It's, you know, go back to football analogy. We don't want to throw an interception while we're in the red zone here. So how we do this as they come out is really important. Can they come out without Congress? Yes, they can. We don't need an act of Congress to get them out of conservatorship. And this administration talks about this as being a priority for them. But we do think that in that process, Congress has a really important role to play. And that goes back to the need for an explicit guarantee. Our concern is if they come out of conservatorship without an explicit backstop on the mortgage-backed securities, not on the entities, but on the product that, you know, $1 trillion+ per year goes into the market. There's $7 trillion outstanding. We want investors to really be attracted to that product. We think the explicit backstop can be done a variety of different ways, but we think there needs to be one as they come out. The second big piece of sort of reform or exit to me is how do we preserve a lot of the changes that were made by FHFA as conservator? How do we keep those in place when they exit? They won't be in conservatorship anymore. So making sure that that level playing field, that the concept of the GSEs shouldn't price differently based on a seller's volume. People shouldn't get special variances because they're large sellers or they're, you know, preferred partners of the GSEs, keeping that level playing field and making that a priority of FHFA to manage that, one of their obligations as the regulator. Those are the kinds of things we want to build into the process coming out.
And I have read, you know, that there are concerns that coming out of conservatorship could cause, you know, increased borrower costs or higher interest rate. I'm assuming you guys feel the same way.
I think what's so important is what Pete said, and, you know, hammering it home. Before the great financial crisis, there was a wink nod, like, oh, these securities are guaranteed by the U.S. government. And that allowed for the affordable 30-year fixed rate mortgage rates that we have historically seen in this country that are an anomaly, right? Nowhere else in the world will you get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage at the rates we enjoy in this country. And that was because before the financial crisis, there was an assumption, which turned out to be correct, that if this all went bad, Uncle Sam would step in and make sure that the security holders were made whole. Well, if we want to continue to have an affordable 30-year fixed rate mortgage with the GSEs exiting conservatorship, we need that explicit guarantee. And that's why it's so important.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, there's a lot of talk that we could go back to the implied guarantee, but you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. I think investors, the people who are going to, we expect to buy $1 trillion+ per year in new securities, the investors that hold the $7+ trillion that are outstanding, I think they need that assurance. Right now, the GSEs are in conservatorship. They are owned by the government. When they come out, and particularly today compared to pre-Great Financial Crisis, debt to GDP ratio was about 50-60%, somewhere in that range. We're over 100% debt to GDP ratio right now. I don't think investors are going to have the same view about an implied guarantee that they did pre-GFC. So that's why we're concerned that, you know, to mitigate the impact, but also to also mitigate the moral hazard of why should investors get the benefit of a bailout without paying for it. So again, explicit backstop paid for by the GSEs, very similar to what we have with Ginnie, is how we think about what the exit should look like.
Pete, I just have to say, I love the analogies. I'm hoping that you have an analogy for every question. Moving on. I also relay almost everything back to sports. So I appreciated the football analogy. Okay. I know we could probably talk GSEs all day. I want to move into the CFPB because that's another very hot topic. Anywhere you look, I think there's hashtags now, RIP CFPB. Justin, do you mind kind of the same question, just breaking down what's going on, but also what's myth and what's fact? Like, what are we kind of looking at here?
Sure. No, I'd be happy to. And the caveat with all of this is I haven't checked Twitter in the last 30 minutes, right? So you never know what actually is the state of play because things are moving so fast. Having said that, let's first address the RIP CFPB, right? Congress created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as part of the Dodd-Frank Act after the Great Financial Crisis. Only Congress could get rid of it. Right. So only Congress could say all the rulemaking authorities that we transferred to the CFPB go back to the agencies that had them pre-financial crisis. So RIP CFPB, I think, is very overstated in the sense that, like, the CFPB as an institution on paper will continue to exist until Congress decides that it no longer does. Now, institutions don't live on paper, right? What is the CFPB actually going to look like? I think that's an open question, right? There's currently a lawsuit in the DC circuit, I believe, where the Treasury Union that represents CFPB employees have stopped the Trump administration from doing mass layoffs at the CFPB. If that's able to go forward, you could see a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that's dramatically reduced in its enforcement capabilities, that's dramatically reduced in supervision capabilities, and dramatically reduced in its ability to write rules, provide guidance, and things like that. And I think it's an open question as to whether the administration would be able to do those dramatic reductions, but taking them kind of at their word, it certainly seems like they want to. So we're going to see what a new CFPB will look like. One thing that does give me optimism is that Jonathan McKernan, who's the nominee from the Trump administration to be the permanent director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has a real deep background in housing finance. He was at FHFA. He worked in GSE reform in the Senate. He's a really sharp guy who was at the FDIC. And he may be the most housing literate director we've ever had at the CFPB in its short history. So I think there's reason for optimism that if there are people to answer the phones and help us out to get the rulemaking clarity we need, that Director McKernan would be an excellent choice to sort of listen and hopefully be persuaded by what the mortgage industry needs to operate more efficiently.
So Justin, if you could, Hannah, I'm going to grab the question asking Mike.
From hey, she asked here. The questions here, Pete. Come on.
No, Pete's got it.
So you see a lot of Twitter feeds and LinkedIn posts that we don't have to worry about enforcement and compliance issues as much because the CFPB is going to be tied in knots and, or to your point, unplugged or deleted or whatever the terminology you want to use. It'd be helpful to walk through why that's a really bad idea to sort of go lax on compliance.
Yeah. So first things first, right? The legal advice you get on LinkedIn and Twitter is worth exactly what you paid for it. So keep that in mind, folks. The second
thing, call your compliance department.
Right, call your compliance department. Don't read a LinkedIn post. No. So like at a threshold level, it's the same thing with the statutes that were created or the laws that were passed during Dodd-Frank. They still exist irrespective of whether the CFPB is enforcing them or not. So all of those laws are still in effect. All of them, a lot of them have private liability. I'd like to point out the loan originator compensation rule has direct personal liability for loan officers that can be privately enforced. That is by aggrieved borrowers, plaintiffs, things like that. So compliance is really important. The other thing to understand is the CFPB is not the only enforcer of these rules. They're the biggest and most prominent enforcer, but state attorneys general explicitly can enforce these Dodd-Frank compliance rules. They can also enforce their own state rules. You have their ability, also state banking departments, to do supervision of IMBs. And then the prudential regulators, OCC, FDIC, and others, do supervise the banks for consumer legal compliance. So it may be a less predictable and more unstable enforcement environment if the CFPB is kind of the cop off the beat. But there's still going to be enforcement. There's still liability. And these statute of limitations are certainly longer than one administration.
Yeah. And of course, that's the last point, Justin, the things that you do between 2025 and 2028, because you think that the CFPB is not going to come looking, there's an election, there's potential for a new CFPB director, and a lot of the things that you were doing prior to that can come back to bite you. So that's a really important piece. And I also think, just as a general matter, the presence of a federal supervisory function on the independent mortgage banker has been very helpful for us to keep sort of the states from doing their own thing. So I don't know how many states Atlantic Bay operates in, probably 30.
No, we're only in 17, but okay. You're going exactly where I wanted to go, because yeah. I live in North Carolina, which is one of the, in my opinion, strictest states. But that's where I want to ask a question around the states. Are you, because I know, you know, we kind of think with the CFPB, you know, kind of, I'm not saying they're going to go away, but if they do go away, seeing the state stepping up and kind of playing a bigger role in regulatory, you know, enforcements and rules and things like that. Are you all thinking the same thing? Are you
100%, right? Mm-hmm. I think some of this happens no matter what, right? In very blue states, when there's the last time we had a Republican CFPB director, on some level, they are going to say, well, we need to step up and do a little more. But it's a matter of degree, right? Like if the CFPB is perceived to be completely off the beat and no longer sort of patrolling the consumer financial marketplace, they're going to do a lot more. And they're going to be a lot more active and do more investigations. So absolutely, I think that there's a real risk that kind of no matter what, you were going to see more state enforcement, but we're absolutely going to see a lot more if the perception is that the CFPB is off the beat. The other thing I would point out, and this has happened before, right, is if we do see mass layoffs at the CFPB, if you look at state attorneys general's offices, there are a lot of CFPB alums that work at those state AG offices. And if they're out there looking for work, that may strengthen actually state enforcement capabilities as those folks move over to state AG or state banking regulators.
Yeah. So the unplug the CFPB stuff is a concern, obviously, because we need people there to rewrite the rules and reform the rules that are in place. It takes rules to fix rules, and it takes people to write them. Justin, sort of a top four list for what we're looking at in terms of reforms might be of interest?
No, I'm happy to do that very quickly. So the top three things, and when I say the top three, you're probably thinking of something else. We're on that too. And if we're not, shoot me an email, because we should be. But the top three things that we're looking at right now are finishing the Reg X servicing reform rule, right? That rule has some real beneficial pieces. It was proposed during Chopra's tenure, but there's some pieces that we think are worth preserving. So we'd like to finalize those. The second is RESPA reform, particularly RESPA Section 8 reform. RESPA is a 50-year-old statute that was passed when people used fax machines. I don't even think they had fax machines, but you know, RESPA predates the fax machine, but it certainly was at a time when you had to like go to the realtor's office and look in their secret book of listings. And we live in a wildly different marketplace, and RESPA should be updated to reflect that. And then the last piece is probably everyone's favorite if you're listening as a loan officer, loan originator compensation, right? The LO comp rule is a statute passed in Dodd-Frank, so we're going to have to live with some measure of compensation regulation by law. But there are ways that you could tweak it in small, sort of measured tweaks that would allow for more freedom for LOs to compete in the marketplace by reducing their own compensation voluntarily. You could exempt state bond loans from compensation requirements, or you could create environments where LO mistakes are able to be recouped by the company in a fashion that's not as, you know, painful as letting people go and things like that. So we're certainly interested in those three as kind of our big three. But to Pete's point, and to kind of hammer it home or belabor this, you know, to dance, you need a dance partner, right? And we need someone at the CFPB who's able to change these rules through the regular notice and comment rulemaking process, because that's how these rules get changed.
So are you guys with the CFPB kind of on pause? I mean, are these the big three, are they on pause right now? I mean, do you all have connections still that can move the needle, or is everything literally paused?
So we continue to do edge before the pause, but after the change in administration, we've had conversations with folks at the Bureau around this. And I should say, like, understanding different views of how things should be structured. The folks at the Bureau that I've dealt with in the regulations area are open-minded, really thoughtful people that are willing to sort of entertain these conversations. So we've been having conversations with them to try and persuade them. I think we are in a little bit of a holding pattern until we get a permanent director. I think it's unlikely that an acting director would undertake these kind of really big regulatory reform projects. But that's why I think it's so positive that Jonathan McKernan was already nominated. So hopefully we'll have a director in the seat relatively soon and can build our relationships with the folks he puts in place to hopefully push this agenda forward.
Yeah. Good news on that front is his nomination hearing is scheduled for the end of the month. So they seem to be moving quickly, which is good.
That is positive. How do you guys see home buyers, specifically first-time home buyers, being affected by all of this change that came with the new administration? Or are they going to be, they're going to be affected.
I mean, look, I I don't think there is a specific change that we anticipate, but it's more around, you know, again, keeping these programs functional, operating. I mean, if you look at FHA and Ginnie in particular, two programs that operate at no cost to the taxpayer, they in fact earn money for the government. So it's really just about keeping that plumbing and operational aspects of those agencies working. Mm-hmm. And you guys and our members go out and do the work every day in terms of, you know, originating FHA, VA, rural housing loans, Fannie Freddie loans, you know, picking up those first time buyers. You know, I think the bigger risks to the first time buyer are the macro risks around rates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I know we're running up on time, but you guys have mentioned FHA a couple of times, and I know you mentioned MIP earlier. Do you all expect any adjustments with those FHA insurance premiums?
So I'd say first, you know, President Trump, I referenced, signed an executive order directing the agencies to find ways to provide price relief for people looking for homes. I mean, this is, I don't know this how the administration is going to view this, but to me, one of the most straightforward tools the administration has is reducing the FHA mortgage insurance premium. Now, we are seeing a bit of an uptick in delinquencies in FHA and actually across all agencies, but particularly in FHA. So I think you would need to look at the factors that are driving that increase in delinquency. But sort of cutting the other way is the fact that the Mutual Mortgage Insurance Fund is over a tick over 11%, right? Statutorily, it needs to be a 2. So hopefully the folks at FHA will say, look, there's enough headroom to possibly reduce the MIP, do a MIP cut that would benefit first-time homebuyers while understanding the risk-layering factors that might be driving delinquency. You know, it's a cliche, but it's here, given the surplus and the MIP we have, you know, maybe you can have your cake and eat it too.
No. Mm-hmm. That's good. I also, going back to homebuyers, like I said, you know, most of us listening to the podcast are, you know, working with buyers, working with a lot of first-time homebuyers that have been on the fence for a really long time. There's already uncertainty with the housing market. Now there's all of this noise around all the administration changes and the CFPB and all of the things. Is there any advice that you would give loan officers when talking to their clients about what's going on in DC?
That's a great question.
So here's honestly the advice I would give. It's like, log, you know, I made a joke about Twitter, but like, it's log off Twitter, right? You can get caught, or Blue Sky or Truth Social, whatever your social media network of choice is. You can't follow these developments in like a hour by hour, because it creates this swirl of noise and uncertainty that is really upsetting. So what I would say, if I was sitting across from a first time home buyer, is you want to buy a home. Home ownership historically has been a great investment in this country. There's nothing that we're seeing that suggests that's not the case. And so, you know, take a risk on the American dream. That's what I'd say.
Yep. And we still have a 30-year fixed rate, freely prepayable mortgage. Are rates high compared to 2020? Sure. High compared to 20, you know, when I bought my first house, I took a pay option ARM in 1986, and it was at 13%. So, you know, I think there are huge opportunities for home buyers today. Buy what you can afford, get a 30-year fixed rate loan, refinance when the opportunity comes.
Yeah, and recognize that rates, people always say, you know, what was a normal rate? Well, a normal rate was the rate when I bought my house. That's what the normal rate, that's what the rate should be. So this will be, you know, psychologically in 2 or 3 years, sixes and sevens will be normal rates. And hopefully people sort of psychologically get to that point.
Yeah.
Those were great answers. That was fantastic. I appreciate you guys coming on so much. I know this is one of our longer episodes, but I think it was so meaningful, and I can't thank you guys enough for coming in and just kind of breaking down everything that's going on. But I can't let you guys leave without asking you each, how do you all plan on lending it forward for the remainder of 2025?
the remainder of 25. You shortened the time horizon, but I was going to answer more in the context.
You can go a full year.
So I am probably in the last 5 years of my career.
Oh.
And as I think about it, and particularly over the last, dozen years, seeing us come out of the great financial crisis and the market that we've built, and there's a lot of really good things that have been put in place. And I think the companies that we have in the business today take all of the responsibilities of providing financing for home ownership really seriously. And so as I think about, it's like, how do we protect that for the long term? We've gotten to a very good place. We have a very good housing finance market today. How do we protect that going forward? And so I spend my time, my last 5 years of my career, I don't want to go through another SNL crisis, subprime crisis, COVID crisis. So that's why I think about sort of the next year, but also the next 4 or 5 years for me.
For me, lending it forward really is about continuing the slow and steady work of making real and meaningful change. MBA has been around for 100 years. As Pete noted, there have been a lot of different crises and changes that have occurred in those 100 years, but the real meaningful change takes long, slow, hard work. And it's not getting distracted by the noise of the story of the day and continuing to do the hard, long-term work in service of our members to make the changes needed to ensure that we have, as Pete said, the best mortgage market in the world.
I love that. And Pete, when you retire in 5 years, I know a podcast that would love to have you if you're looking for a side hustle.
That would be great. I could use a side hustle.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming on to Lending Forward. We're excited to see where the year takes us.
It's going to be a ride.
So really enjoyed it.
Bye.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube and LinkedIn. Tune in next week for another new episode and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSconsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia 23452.